Hanford site, as you may well know, was a site of a lot of plutonium production from about 1947 to 1987, after which it was shut down and promptly reopened as probably the largest nuclear waste site in the Western Hemisphere. And the waste streams there are very complicated, and they range in a whole range of conditions. But the general remediation strategy has been to, the proposed remediation strategies have always involved removal or sealing off of the leaks. And so what I'm going to discuss with you today is some evaluation of some remediation methods and how that would be impacted when rainwater eventually contacts with these soils that are have a lot of contamination in them. The what you see here are some tanks, large storage tanks which held this caustic radioactive waste. About 67 of these tanks have leaked, total estimated amount about 100 million gallons of caustic radioactive waste. This stuff is a self-boiling liquid. The radioactivity is so high that it causes it to self-boil. The molarity can be as high as 10 molar, and pH is generally above 13.5. So it's quite an extreme environment. When this comes in contact with the soil, it can actually start to change the soil structure and weather those minerals. And this release of this this waste is a major problem because of the proximity of the Hanford site to the Columbia River, and what that's shown here. There we go. That's shown here. The largest wastes were generally in this 100 area, right adjacent to the Columbia River. Downstream from this is a Indian reservation that gets a lot of their subsistence fishing from the Columbia River. Further downstream is Portland, and so there's a lot of concern that this, in particular, cesium and strontium are going to start to impact this ecosystem as it migrates down. For the good thing is, in terms of radionucleotides, they have a half-life of about 30 years, and so in that sense, we're not looking at something that's going to be around for 10,000 years, but 30 years is still quite a long time. And when this caustic waste comes in contact with the soil, as I mentioned before, it causes the soil minerals to rapidly dissolve, and new minerals start to precipitate. For instance, cankerite and sodalite, which are feldspathoid minerals that have cage-like structures and can trap the main radioactive compounds, cesium and strontium, within these cages. And a lot of work has been done to sort of evaluate the uptake of cesium and strontium into these minerals, or the sorption of cesium and strontium to frayed edge sites and to clay edges in the soil structure. But what has not been done, and what we are looking at, is the condition when you've removed these high pH wastes, and you're now asking what happens when rainwater is eventually coming in contact with these sediments that have cesium and strontium in them and is now contacting these soils that are now very undersaturated with respect to these cankerite and sodalite minerals. And so to investigate this, we took some cesium and strontium contaminated solutions, and we contacted it with the sediments under several different treatment conditions. I'm shown here as ambient CO2 and a CO2-free condition. And we've also did a treatment which had a high contaminant level, 10 to the third molar, and a low contaminant level of cesium and strontium. The reasons for this is that the dissolution kinetics are quite different at the different concentrations of the contaminants, and we think that there may be a strontium carbonate precursor that could be important. After about 6 months of aging, these sediments were taken out and washed and freeze-dried, and in general we saw that about 10% of the cesium was sorbed onto the sediments, and about 50% of the strontium. So now what I'd like to show you is the release of those constituents. I won't talk a lot about the uptake side, it's been discussed in the past, but the release of those cesium, those constituents once you contact with pore water. And the notation that I'll be using is high here for a high ambient CO2 condition, low ambient CO2. And then here when we have a CO2-free condition, high minus CO2 and low minus CO2. So just briefly to show you what was done, we took a background pore water solution, contacted it through a column, and then collected it in a fraction collector. And in particular, what we're interested in is there's a couple exchange reactions that we would expect to dominate, which is calcium exchanging for strontium and potassium exchanging for cesium. This has been shown in the past on laboratory analogs, but not with sediments themselves. And then we also expect mineral dissolution of these felspathoid minerals, which would involve the release of aluminum, silica, nitrite, and then strontium and cesium. What's shown here is the fraction of strontium that's remaining in the sediment. And so you see, as we start out, we see a lot of release, in particular of these the sediments that were reacted under no CO2 conditions, shown here and shown here in green. Not sure exactly why this is the case. It was actually opposite of what I would have predicted. And we're conducting a lot of excess, strontium excess in particular, studies to try to understand what is going on in this case. But I want to focus right now in on this early part of the curve, which is where you'd expect to see the ion exchange reactions. And if we blow up that part of the curve, this is shown here in strontium concentration on the y-axis versus pore volumes. And this is calcium concentration, and there's a strong correlation. So what is happening is there's a calcium snowplow that's coming along and pushing that strontium off of the exchange sites. And so you can see how these match up very well. Here's the low, minus CO2, et cetera. When we look at cesium, we see much the same thing in that these treatments that were reacted under low CO2 tended to release more cesium as well. If you look here, the low CO2 here, and there's its analog with the ambient conditions. The release curves are a little bit different, and you'll notice this part of the curve, the ion exchange portion, is a bit different. I want to zoom in on that now again. And if we look at from 0 to 300 pore volumes, again, similar type of curve. We see a strontium concentration on the y-axis and a break in the axis, high treatments, low treatments. And we see a strong correlation between cesium release and the breakthrough curve of potassium. Again, this is, in essence, a potassium snowplow pushing the cesium off of their, in particular, most likely the frayed edge sites. What's interesting and what's important is that after this case has happened, there's still quite a bit of cesium and strontium on the exchange. And so after this point, we really are looking at a case where mineral dissolution is governing the release of these constituents. And so we can take that data and try to calculate a release rate in the mineral dissolution portion of the curve. And that's what is shown here. The highlighted area here is a time frame between 300 and 400 pore volumes. And we can calculate a release rate of strontium and cesium, and that's shown here in units of millimoles of strontium or cesium per kilogram per day. And again, I just want to point out that these treatments that had the low CO2 conditions were releasing more cesium and strontium than the ambient CO2 conditions. And again, I'm not sure why that's the case. It's opposite of what I would expect. If we are truly getting dissolution of these felspathoid minerals, then we would expect also a release of silica and aluminum at about a 1-to-1 ratio. When we look at the release rates of silica and aluminum, we see that indeed we're getting quite a bit of a release of silica, but not nearly as much aluminum as we might expect. So why might that be? And we suspected that there's aluminum reprecipitation. For instance, gibbsite would be predicted to reprecipitate. And so we conducted a stop flow experiment way out at the end, I think around 500 pore volumes. We stopped the flow for 24 hours, not a long time, and then restarted the flow. And you can see that when we did that, we had a drop in the aluminum concentration and a subsequent increase in most of the treatments for cesium and strontium. So again, this is evidence that we're having some type of aluminum reprecipitation, most likely gibbsite, and that strontium and cesium are not part of that new precipitate. So in summary, what we see is that the majority of the cesium and strontium remain on these sediments after ion exchange reactions have, after the ion exchange sites have been saturated with calcium and potassium. And this is what we suspected from prior work that has been done on this project, but has never really been shown. And so it's interesting because it's a different direction than DOE has gone in the past to understand the final fate of this site. And then as a corollary of that, dissolution and reprecipitation reactions are therefore very important in terms of governing the eventual fate or movement of these constituents. And that cesium or strontium and cesium are less tightly retained in the low CO2 treatments. Again, I'm not sure why that is. The next step is that we've made quite a bit of way to take this data and use reactive transport model crunch with Carl Stiefel, one of the co-authors on this presentation. But it's not quite there, and modeling is one of those things that unless it's complete, it doesn't really tell you much until you've got the whole thing done. So that will be the next talk, maybe in the spring. So I just want to acknowledge, in addition to the co-authors, Mary Kay Amistadi, who was responsible for the ICP analysis, and then Sung-Kyung Choi, who provided the SEM images you saw, and also is doing the strontium XS. And the funding source is the Department of Energy. So thank you, and I'll take any questions here. Yes. We don't. I mean, I think that we haven't really looked for that closely. That's a good. Although you know, I'm not sure. For instance, on what? The quick answer is no. We don't have any evidence. But the long term answer is we haven't looked that closely to see if we do. Yes. The sediments that have been impacted surrounding the Hanford site, but these are pristine sediments. So it's a similar. You can't actually. It's very difficult to get soils that have been. And actually, not that much work has been done on the sediments that have actually become contaminated. They're very. You know, they're over 100 degrees Celsius. They're extremely radioactive. You need. I don't know. Like approval up to the president to walk into that area, and but we used a sediment that was very close to that. So it would be, if you're familiar with it, it's like a Hanford. It would be called the Hanford fine sand. Okay. Oh, is there time for a moment? Yes.
Sorry, did you present pH data?
I didn't, but I can tell you what it looks like, and it's important. pH starts off really high, as you might expect. Maybe I can quickly use something else to show you it. And I think that's part of, let's see. Okay, so let's say the pH, if this was pH 10 instead of 100, then the pH starts out like right around here and then drops down pretty rapidly, you know, after 10 or 20 pore volumes. By the time we get out to about 80 pore volumes, which would be about here, the pH is back down to 7.2. And I think what's happening is we're flushing out a sodium carbonate that precipitated in this, because we also have a lot of sodium that comes off at that pH as well, or at those early stages too.
And the behavior is the same in both the high and the low CO2 system?
Yeah, that was quite surprising. There was not a large difference between in pH. I thought for sure that was going to, but that both, there's a lot of carbonates in these sediments. And so I think that we tried to look at a treatment that had no CO2 versus CO2 in the headspace, but the bottom line was these are soils that developed in a carbonate-rich area. There's a lot of carbonates in the sediments, so in fact, the soil that was in the no CO2 treatment actually took up, the sediment itself took up. There was a release of carbonate from the soil into the solution over the course of the reaction, so there's a lot of carbonate in there anyways. Yeah, we had thought about it, and that may happen. The way that would not in the uptake side of things, but what the scenario that would be interesting would be to add something like oxalic acid, something that might mimic, you know, plant root exudates that would eventually come in contact with this, and would that help dissolve some of these minerals? They're actually quite resistant to, in particular for cesium, to dissolution. So that's encouraging. But yeah, that's on the works, but I think a little bit down the line. Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.